As we continue in worship, today is a little bit of a different format, and you'll see what I mean as we sort of walk it out. Today is the first day of our Easter series. Easter is 2 weeks from today. Hard to believe. It's one of the early, like, Easter times. And as we walk up to it, we're going to do so almost chronologically. Like, Easter, we're going to celebrate the resurrection. Good Friday, we're going to celebrate the crucifixion. On Maundy Thursday, we're going to celebrate the fellowship of the love feast, the foot washing and communion, the commemoration of the death of the Lord, and remember him together. On Palm Sunday, next week, we're going to celebrate the upside-down kingship of Jesus that makes no sense at all. And if anyone knows someone that has a donkey and wants to let us borrow it next week, that'd be great. But with one of those bags to catch the poop. Just put that in there. All right. And today we're going to talk about the ministry of Christ and the life of Jesus. As we look at the ministry of Christ, and as we look at what it is that Jesus did, like, while he lived here on earth, I'm not really sure why. I mean, I read this book a while ago, but there's this concept. I think I talked about it last week too, and I'm going to talk about it again today. It's the concept of remembering. Madeline L'Engle is where I got this from. She's a great author, writes some children's fiction, and was one of my favorite authors growing up, still is. And as a believer, she has this theological concept where she says that God calls us all to do great things, like have a relationship with him, and like live a holy life, and be used of God to heal people, and to even, like, walk on water, you know, and things like this. Like, she looks back at these things, and she thinks, if you've ever read Watchman Nee, The Normal Christian Life, you know, where Nee essentially says the normal Christian life is to live sort of the way Jesus did. Where, you know, you can heal people and you can do great things, and it's not like nothing's outside of your grasp, that's what God calls you to. And L'Engle uses the concept of remembering to do this. Like, she says, in the garden, everything was right. You know, fellowship with God was right. Everything was good. There was no brokenness at that spot. Adam and Eve, they cared for the garden and they stewarded the garden. They worked in the garden. It was beautiful. Everything was right. Like, great things always happened there. And when the curse broke humanity and when the fall happened, we forgot how to be image bearers. Sin mars the spiritual memory. And part of living the Christian life now is remembering. And so when Peter walked on water, it wasn't a miracle. He just remembered how to do it. And when Paul healed people in Acts, was it a miracle? Oh, sure, I mean, it was a big deal, but he just simply remembered. He remembered how to connect to God in that way. You know, when Jesus did the work that he did on earth, he just remembered how to have the faith to do it. You know, I mean, it's these incredible things of this is how we're meant to live. So often, though, we overthink things. Right? And we overthink particularly ourselves. We like to put ourselves at the center of our theology. We like to put ourselves at the center of our world. And from ourselves, then, we want to try to stem off of that and do great things. And we wonder why we can't do great things then. And the reason why is because I'm at the center. I'm at the center, and Christ isn't at the center. I'm remembering who I am instead of remembering who he is. And so when it comes to thinking about the ministry of Christ and walking up to Easter together, when it came to the, I mean, we could have preached a sermon about this. We could have preached a sermon about the ministry of Jesus. But I just don't think that would have helped us remember well. We didn't hear that from the Lord. What we did hear is, I think that we forget the simplicity of what it means to hear the story of Christ. We've gotten so used to Jesus. We've gotten so casual with this story. We've become so sometimes even complacent with it that we forget the newness of it, and we forget the beauty of who Christ really was. And I think that it's good for us to take the Bible and to get into it, you know, to examine the original language and to see all the nuances of what it is that God says. And is it a deep book? Absolutely. But it's also a great story. It's just a great story Like, how many of you like to read a great story or see a great story in a movie? You know, and what's in there? I mean, intrigue is in there, and suspense, and drama, and love, and war, and the Bible has all these things. This is a great story. I mean, it's got intrigue and suspense and drama and war and love stories and heroes and villains, and it's a great story. And when we read the stories of Jesus, we forget that. That there is a huge story at work that he's the focal point of, that he's the center point of, and we overthink it, and we get too far beyond the simplicity of being children who hear a story and are delighted by it. Right? When my kids and I were currently reading through The Hobbit, and when I say, you know, sometimes you get to bed late, you know, we can't read The Hobbit every night because you can't just read The Hobbit in like a couple of paragraphs. You know, you got to keep the story moving. But if I say, tonight we're going to read The Hobbit, whoa, man, they're excited. You know, it's wonderful because here's a story, here's an adventure for me to step into. And we forget that Jesus wants us to step into his story as well. And so here's what I want you to do. Tim's actually going to lead us in storytelling today. And the band, all of our music for the rest of the time is going to be reflective on the story, on the stories that Tim tells us about Jesus. But I'd like for us to take a moment and to cleanse ourselves. So let's close our eyes. Let's close our eyes. Let's bow our heads. Now, just for a second, all right? All of your files are backed up on a hard drive somewhere, okay? But in your mind, in your heart, in your spirit, in your brain, I'd like you to take out the file that's labeled Jesus and just hit the delete button. All right, just delete it. And don't worry, you'll get it all back. It's all backed up. But take all the stuff that you've thought that you've known, the stories that you've heard, the flannel graph that you've seen, the YouTube videos, whatever, the teaching, just wipe it all clean. And let's approach Jesus like we haven't heard about him before. And let's just hear about some of the things that he did. And let's let that speak to our spirits. God, show us to yourselves, show yourself to us new and fresh today. Take away the stale things that we've heard and seen, the things that have gotten old to us. Help us to interact with you new today and hear your story. Thank you for calling us to join the story that you have been working all down through creation. You are the center point. And we focus and want to, we want to get you today. We want to hear you today. We want to see you and feel you and touch you and taste you and all those things today. So I pray that you would, through your spirit, enable our new experience of you together. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we begin, I have a message for all of our young men and women that are in here with us. My son, William. Hi, Trey. Thanks for the wave. My son, William, says, Dad, we're down here again? I said, yes, you are down here again. And for William and all his friends that are down here again from the upstairs class today, it's very, very important that you're here. You are very important being here because you bring a presence to us, the bigger people in the room, in what storytelling is all about, because you ask great questions and you come to us, the bigger people, with a more open imagination. And so it's really important that you're here, and you are very important. And you'll have a role a little bit later in the morning. And we're glad that you're with us. And I think for those of us that maybe didn't bring or have a young man or woman with us this morning, they're part of us. We're all family. And the importance of their presence here today is huge. You can't say it was just another ordinary day, like any other day, not when you're with him. This day found us smack in the middle of some nasty bickering about this tally the Pharisees were keeping on how many converts and baptisms there had been between he and John the Baptist. Rather than allowing it to become a distraction there among them, he decided to head back to Galilee, passing through that place. Said he had to pass through that place. Well, he didn't, no sir. Plenty of other travelers find a way around just fine. No need to set foot there, to have to bump into those people. We followed anyway. We came into the town with a famous watering hole and got him settled in after our travels so he could rest and be refreshed. Next, we all headed into the city center to stock up on supplies. Even though we were not entirely thrilled to be there, knowing the reputation of these people, we were hungry and we needed to eat. I just wasn't sure about being there that day, around them, buying their produce and goods. It was uncomfortable, yet we just followed him. Coming back to where we left him at the well, we were shocked to find him sitting alone with one of those people, and not just one of them, but a woman at any rate. This doesn't look good. Does he not realize what this means? He's already under fire for controversial statements about himself and others. He's already causing a stir with what he's doing among the people, you know, like healing them. Anyone who wants to find something against him sure could hear. We kept following him. He recounted his experience with her as she approached the well around lunch, the hottest time of the day, most likely trying to avoid further scorn from foreigners and her own people alike. He told us he asked her to get him a drink. And this woman was stunned. "What?" she says. "Why are you talking with me anyway? Everyone knows that your people don't talk with my people. Why would you want anything from me?" she says. He said to her that he could give her something that would free her from the chains of trying to find what she thinks she needs in herself, that he would provide her something that would release her from the pain of attempting to find what she thinks will fill her in one of countless broken relationships. See, he told her all about herself. He knew her and saw her in a way that she could not see on her own. Then he revealed who he is to her. Yeah, who he really is. He never did that before. "What is going on?" we say to each other. He always kept this close. Now even as his own countrymen are questioning him, he shares his identity with her, and then she drops her stuff and heads into town to tell others. This woman starts telling men in the town about him, inviting them to come and see him. And they did come on account of her, and determined for themselves that he is who he said he is. More and more came believing, and an outcast city began turning to him. We continue following. I'm going to be sharing two different accounts of the same story, one's found in Matthew, one's found in John. And at the end of this, I'm going to ask us to just get into some groups with the people around us. And for those groups that have our boys and girls from upstairs with them, boys and girls, you will get to have a leading role in your group with getting to pick the question your group is going to talk about. And I will give those to you here after we finish the story. So John was beheaded in prison, and his head was brought on a tray and given to the girl, who took it to her mother. Later, John's disciples came for his body and buried it. And then they went and told Jesus what had happened. As soon as Jesus heard the news, he left in a boat to a remote area to be alone. But the crowds heard where he was headed and followed on foot from many towns. Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. That evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "That isn't necessary. You feed them." "But we have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. "Bring them here," he said. And he told the people to sit down on the grass. Jesus took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, looked up toward heaven, and blessed them. Then, breaking the loaves into pieces, he gave the bread to the disciples, who distributed it to the people. They all ate as much as they wanted, and afterward, the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftovers. About 5,000 men were fed that day, in addition to all the women and children. Immediately after this, Jesus insisted that his disciples get back into the boat and cross to the other side of the lake while he sent the people home. After sending them home, he went up into the hills by himself to pray. Night fell while he was there alone. Meanwhile, the disciples were in trouble far away from land, for a strong wind had risen and they were fighting heavy waves. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came toward them, walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. In their fear, they cried out, "It's a ghost!" But Jesus spoke to them at once. "Don't be afraid," he said. "Take courage, I'm here." Then Peter called to him, "Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come to you, walking on the water." "Yes, come," Jesus said. So Peter went over the side of the boat and walked on the water toward Jesus. But when he saw the strong wind and the waves, he was terrified and began to sink. "Save me, Lord," he shouted. Jesus immediately reached out and grabbed him. "You have so little faith," Jesus said. "Why did you doubt me?" When they climbed back into the boat, the wind stopped. Then the disciples worshiped him. "You really are the Son of God," they exclaimed. Same story. After this, Jesus crossed over to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, also known as the Sea of Tiberias. A huge crowd kept following him wherever he went because they saw his miraculous signs as he healed the sick. Then Jesus climbed a hill and sat down with his disciples around him. It was nearly the time for the Jewish Passover celebration. Jesus soon saw a huge crowd of people coming to look for him. And turning to Philip, he asked, "Where can we buy bread to feed all these people?" He was testing Philip, for he already knew what he was going to do. Philip replied, "Even if we worked for months, we wouldn't have enough money to feed them." Then Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "There's a young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what good is that with this huge crowd?" "Tell everyone to sit down," Jesus said. So they all sat down on the grassy slopes. Men alone numbered around 5,000. Then Jesus took the loaves, gave thanks to God, and distributed them to the people. Afterward, he did the same with the fish, and they all ate as much as they wanted. After everyone was full, Jesus told his disciples, "Now gather the leftovers so that nothing is wasted." So they picked up the pieces and filled 12 baskets with scraps left by the people who had eaten from the 5 barley loaves. When the people saw him do this miraculous sign, they exclaimed, "Surely he is the prophet we have been expecting." When Jesus saw that they were ready to force him to be their king, he slipped away into the hills by himself. And that evening, Jesus' disciples went down to the shore to wait for him. But as darkness fell, and Jesus still hadn't come back, they got into the boat and headed across the lake toward Capernaum. Soon a gale swept down upon them, and the sea grew very rough. They had rowed 3 or 4 miles when suddenly they saw Jesus walking on the water toward the boat. They were terrified, but he called out to them, "Don't be afraid, I am here." And then they were eager to let him in the boat, and immediately they arrived at their destination. On his return, Jesus was welcomed by a crowd. They were all there expecting him. A man came up, Jairus by name. He was president of the meeting place. He fell at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house because his 12-year-old daughter, his only child, was dying. Jesus went with him, making his way through the pushing and jostling crowd. In the crowd that day, there was a woman who for 12 years had been afflicted with hemorrhages. She had spent every penny she had on doctors, but not one had been able to help her. She slipped in from behind and touched the edge of Jesus' robe. At that very moment, her hemorrhaging stopped. Jesus said, "Who touched me?" When no one stepped forward, Peter said, "But Master, we've got crowds of people on our hands. Dozens have touched you." Jesus insisted, "Someone touched me. I felt power going out of me." When the woman realized that she couldn't remain hidden, she knelt trembling before him. In front of all the people, she blurted out her story, why she touched him, and how at the same moment she was healed. Jesus said, "Daughter, you took a risk trusting me, and now you're healed and whole. Live well, live blessed." While he was still talking, someone from the leader's house came up and told him, "Your daughter died. No need now to bother the teacher." Jesus overheard and said, "Don't be upset. Just trust me, and everything will be all right." Going into the house, he wouldn't let anyone enter with him except Peter, John, James, and the child's parents. Everyone was crying and carrying on over her. And Jesus said, "Don't cry. She didn't die. She's sleeping." And they laughed at him. They knew she was dead. Then Jesus, gripping her hand, called, "My dear child, get up." She was up in an instant, up and breathing again. He told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were ecstatic, but Jesus warned them to keep quiet. "Don't tell a soul what happened in this room." Dwayne, if you can bring up the next slide. And this is for us individually, personal reflection. You can see the questions on the slide. I'll read them. We'll take some time just between us and the Lord to reflect on these questions, and then again, the worship team will bring us back in response. Talk about Jairus. So as you think about this with the Lord, talk about this man, the father of the dying girl. If you were him, how would you respond to Jesus? Or to the woman who touched Jesus' robe? Or to the crowd? What difference do you see in how Jairus approached Jesus and how the woman afflicted with bleeding approaches him? And who do you think Jesus intended to impact through each of his miracles here? With the woman who touched Jesus' robe and with the girl he raised from the dead? And what can we see about who Jesus is through these interwoven accounts? This is time for personal reflection. This is a reflection from a gentleman named Dr. Wagner. Story of the raising of Lazarus from the dead is the last and greatest miracle of Jesus in this gospel. Jesus' friend Lazarus had become ill. The sisters, Mary and Martha, sent word to Jesus that he should come to Bethany to cure Lazarus of this deadly disease. Jesus delays his return and Lazarus dies. And some commentators suggest that Lazarus was probably dead by the time the message reached Jesus. But the delay only serves to alert the listeners to the story that Lazarus would have been dead sometime before Jesus finally arrives in the city. By the time Jesus arrives, Lazarus had been dead 4 days, in the tomb 3 days. Upon discovering that Lazarus was dead, Jesus begins to weep. He feels deeply the loss and the pain that the death of a friend brings. Even as he is caught up in the emotion of losing a friend, there were some complainers who wondered aloud why he could cure a blind man and not keep his friend from dying. Jesus then requested Martha to take away the stone from the front of the burial cave, and she objects, saying that the stench would be too great. He had been dead 4 days, and decomposition would have begun. It would not be pleasant. The Jews did not embalm their dead as did the Egyptians, and so decay would start very quickly. With this added detail, the power of Jesus over death would be shown. It was not simply a resurrection of someone who had been in a coma for a short time, but a person who was not only dead, but in the process of decomposing. Jesus prayed a prayer of thanksgiving. Notice, there was no request that God raise Lazarus, but rather a thanksgiving that this would happen so that people would know and believe. Although we realize that even this greatest of all miracles would not assure the witnesses would remain faithful to Jesus for long. Then all of a sudden, it happened. Lazarus comes out of the tomb in response to Jesus' call. He comes floating out of the burial cave. We note that he was still bound in the burial clothes, hands and feet. Others had to untie, unwrap him. Once they realized he was alive, their sorrow, weeping, and sense of loss evaporated and were replaced by joy and celebration. How might Lazarus have known Jesus through his experience of resurrection? And the crazy thing is that the outcome of this wonderful miracle was that the Pharisees and the scribes became more active in their plotting to kill Jesus.